ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 21st of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. It came down to the wire, but Labor's hate speech laws have passed Parliament with support from the Liberals. The legislation, drafted in the wake of the Bondi terror attack, was debated in the Senate until late in the night, with 38 voting in favour and 22 against. The coalition failed to settle a formal joint position, with the Nationals opposing the bill when it reached the Senate. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this story.
Peter Wertheim from Australia's peak Jewish body was watching from inside the Senate chamber as the federal government's hate laws were put to a vote.
I felt relieved that after so much effort in such a compressed time frame, the law has been passed.
The co-chair of the Executive Council of Australian Jewry welcomes the outcome.
It was gratifying to see both the government and the opposition, at least the Liberals in the opposition, come together and combine to make sure this bill was passed comfortably.
The reforms, drafted in response to the Bondi attack, passed the Senate late on Tuesday night with support from the Liberal Party. On the final day of an urgent sitting of Parliament, Labor and the Liberals struck a deal to tighten the scope of the legislation. Labor Senator Deborah O'Neill.
Hate will only spread and further entrench itself throughout our community the longer we wait in calling it out and the longer we wait to bring about the legislative changes necessary.
Shadow Home Affairs Minister Jonathan Dunningham has been critical of the government's approach to drafting the laws, but ultimately provided support.
Voting against these laws enables people who come here to spread hate to stay here on a visa. We can't deal with them. They can come in. We can't stop them. That's why these laws are important. It's important to take back control of this situation so that we can actually deal with the hate these people have brought.
But the National Party is split from its coalition partner, voting against the laws after days of deliberation. A statement from the party's leader, David Littleproud, saying the Nationals support the intent of the legislation, but that it needs changes to prevent unintended consequences that limit freedom of speech. National Senator Bridget McKenzie spoke about the bill last night.
Unfortunately, despite the many positive elements of this legislation, the government has not been able to convince my party room that adequate safeguards are in place for the proposed hate crimes.
Earlier, the government's gun laws, which include establishing a national firearm buyback scheme, passed the Senate with support from the Greens. Bridget McKenzie was among National Senators who voted against the bill, arguing it punishes law-abiding firearm owners.
We know it's not the gun that saw 15 lives lost, Jewish Australians targeted on the 14th of December.
The lower house will adjourn this morning, while a national day of mourning for the victims of the Bondi terrorist attack is on Thursday.
Romy Stevens reporting there. And for more, Foreign Minister Penny Wong joined me a short time ago. Minister, thanks for joining us on AM after a late night in the Senate for yourself and others. Do you think Australians can be satisfied that this is a strong package of hate speech laws after all the amendments that were made?
Isabella, the Bondi attackers had hatred in their minds and guns in their hands, and the laws passed last night tackle both of those. Now, obviously, we have had to make changes in order to get the coalition to support it. In particular, we've had to remove some of the strongest provisions that were put into the bill, provisions that had been called for by Gillian Siegel, the special envoy against anti-Semitism, because the coalition would not support them. But having said that, these are the strongest hate laws the country has ever passed, and the gun laws would have ensured that non-citizens, such as the father who was involved in who was one of the murderers in the Bondi massacre, would not have got a gun.
You made it clear you would have liked to have seen those racial vilification laws included in this legislation. Changes were being made down to the wire. There wasn't much time to explain how this legislation is going to work to the public. Is that really best practice, particularly when there was this sensitivity of these laws being introduced after a horrific terror attack?
As you said, this was an horrific terrorist attack. 15 Jewish Australians were murdered. We, as a government, have been working methodically through this legislation. We recognise the urgency. And, you know, let's remember through the Christmas New Year period, the Coalition were calling for Parliament to be recalled. Then when Parliament was recalled, they were against that. They called for hate speech to be dealt with, and then they opposed those provisions. They called for Gillian Segal's report to be implemented, and then they opposed one of the recommendations being implemented. And what you did see last night is this. At a time Australians want unity, Susan Lee could not unite the Coalition, with Coalition senators voting against the bill and for the bill.
And look, as I said, not too much time for the public to really get their head around these laws as well. There was some confusion about where the line is drawn with these new hate laws. Last night, your colleague Michelle Rowland was asked whether groups that accuse Israel of committing genocide in Gaza or argue that Israel should not exist as a state could be banned under proposed new hate crime laws. What's your understanding?
Well, I think it's very important first to understand what the laws do. These laws do a number of things. One of the things they do is give the Minister for Home Affairs the power to suspend and cancel visas for people who have come to Australia to spread hate. Another aspect of the laws is the one to which you refer, which is it gives ministers the power to prescribe hate groups, that is only on the advice of the Director General of AGO, and after consultation with the Attorney General. And the focus of those laws is on those organisations which are seeking to incite hate crimes. So it is legislation which is very clear about trying to crack down on those who are seeking to incite criminal behaviour motivated by hatred. It is not legislation which is designed to prevent differences of views and freedom of speech.
So just to be clear, groups that are opposed to Israel's existence or critical of the nation, could they be banned under those laws?
Look, as I said, it's not designed to prevent political debate, although I note that some of the things you're putting to me are clearly contrary to government policy. What it is designed to do is to crack down on organisations which are seeking to incite hate crimes. And the checks and balances which have been put into this legislation, which include two ministers' engagement and the leader of the opposition to be briefed, I think does demonstrate that we are seeking to get that balance right. We do. Freedom of expression is important in our country. But I think with the rise of anti-Semitism and in the wake of the worst terrorist attack that this country has seen on Australian soil, we really do need to continue to strengthen our response to hate and those who seek to spread hate in our society.
And several of your colleagues have said that there is going to be further legislative response to come, particularly as we watch the Bondi Royal Commission. I might just move on to some other news now. This is happening as many countries are considering Donald Trump's invitation to be on the so-called Board of Peace. Can Australia seriously consider this when the US is actively trying to take another autonomous region?
We have received an invitation to be part of the Board of Peace along with many other countries. We are considering that and engaging with the United States to understand more fully their intention and the operation of the board, and we are engaging with other partners on this.
Look, another issue that the ABC has been contacted by hundreds of audience members about is the changes to the UK and Ireland's new passport rules for dual citizens. Many who say they've been left scrambling, locked out of their home country. Is there an opportunity to ask the UK to delay these changes?
I have seen the concern that people have raised about that, both publicly and obviously engagement with the community. These are changes to UK entry requirements which the United Kingdom has put in place for all dual citizens, so not just Australians but all of their citizens. So obviously This is a broader change that many Australian British dual citizens are caught up in. We've conveyed these concerns to the British High Commission, and I hope we can work through this.
Minister Penny Wong, I think we might be out of time, but thank you very much for joining us on AM this morning.
Good to speak with you.
US President Donald Trump has doubled down on his demands to own Greenland. His escalating hostilities have sparked outrage and defiance from EU nations who have sought to present a united front at the World Economic Forum. The ABC's America's editor, John Lyons, joins me now from Washington. Good morning, John.
Morning, Isabella.
The US President is speaking now at the White House. What's he had to say?
Well, Isabella, he is reflecting on his first year back in office in his second term. He's been speaking now for more than 2 hours non-stop. It's quite extraordinary, running through what he says are his achievements, which interestingly, he's listed the critical minerals deal that he signed with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese as one of the highlights of his first year. And others include things like delivering a record stock market, strong US economy, and then he's looked at things like pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, tougher borders. He has said that the immigration or the ICE agents trying to track down and deport illegal migrants has been a highlight. And so he's basically, it's a message to a lot of his base that these are the things that he said he would do and that he's in fact gone ahead and done them.
And John, his threats about Greenland has been in the news a lot. Many of America's closest allies are warning of a rupture between Washington and European nations. How serious is this rupture?
I think it's serious. It's not quite yet at crisis level, but it's serious and it's certainly moving in a dangerous direction. Donald Trump, of course, has talked about putting tariffs on a lot of European countries who may be opposing his takeover of Greenland. In response, the Europeans are talking about activating a part of the European Union agreement under which they can hit US or any country with increased tariffs. But what's happening now is both the French President Emmanuel Macron and the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney have both come out very strongly. Emmanuel Macron has referred to we don't respect bullies. Let's have a listen to what the French President and the Canadian Prime Minister said.
We need more stability in this world, but we do prefer respect to bullies. We do prefer science to plotism, and we do prefer rule of law to brutality.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons, tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited.
John, it's Greenland this week. There's also been the announcement of the US's Board of Peace. There's been no shortage of headlines during the first year of Donald Trump's second term as president. You're sitting there watching that speech. How would you characterize this first year?
It's been a year of massive disruption. That's actually what Donald Trump promised his base, that it would be the end of the status quo, and he's delivered on that. What we're seeing now in this first year, we've seen essentially before our eyes, we're seeing the end of the rules-based order. We're seeing all of the understanding since World War II underpinned by NATO. All of that is being challenged now. Donald Trump's challenging every single tenet of that. And the world's moving far more from a world where countries knew where they stood. Countries like Australia knew where they stood. They were in certain alliances. So were NATO countries, to a world where might is right, where the stronger and the tougher are surviving, survival of the fittest. And I think that the world's moving into a very different, possibly dangerous phase.
A big year, as you say, John, ABC's America's editor. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Israeli authorities have stormed a United Nations compound in occupied East Jerusalem and begun demolition of the former headquarters of the UN's dedicated Palestinian aid organization. It's the latest escalation in Israel's long-running campaign against UNRWA and is being labelled as a serious violation of international law. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
The bright orange arm of a large digger crashes through the tin roof standing over the entrance to the compound.
Nixon excites the security office, which once screened staff and visitors passing through the gates. For almost a year, the UNRWA facility in occupied East Jerusalem has been near empty. Foreign staff were forced to leave last January when a legislated ban on UNRWA operating in Israel came into effect and their visas were ripped up. Now the facility, which has stood there since 1952, is also torn apart. Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir wandering through the compound with Jerusalem's deputy mayor as the demolition began and posting video on his social media channels.
It's a historic day, it's a festive day, and it's a very important day for the control of Jerusalem. For years, these terror supporters were here. Today, these terror supporters are being removed from here with all that they have established.
It's an allegation the Israeli government and some in the community have levelled against UNRWA for many years, but which has intensified since the deadly October 7 attacks on Israel. The accusation is that the UN agency dedicated to supporting the Palestinian population was infiltrated by Hamas and needed to be shut down, and that its staff had been among those to kill Israelis and take others hostage. An internal probe led to the sacking of 9 staff, but the UN has repeatedly insisted Israeli claims the entire agency is rotten are unfounded. Rolando Gomez is a spokesperson for the UN's Human Rights Council.
This is a new level of open and deliberate defiance of international law, including of the privileges and immunities of the United Nations by the State of Israel.
Ben, a member of right-wing Zionist organization Im Tirtzu, watched the demolition from the roadside.
And I think any normal country would have done what Israel is doing after this specific organization and its employees killed and butchers Israelis on the 7th of October.
The Israeli ban on UNRWA's operations also extends to any dealing with UNRWA staff, making the agency's work providing services ranging from healthcare and education to even rubbish collection in some Palestinian communities much more difficult. It's been criticised by the International Court of Justice, which has also ruled Israel's occupation of East Jerusalem, the West Bank and Gaza is illegal. Palestinian activist and Jerusalem resident Mohammed Abu Humas says the demolition is a result of failure by the international community to call out Israel's conduct.
This is a sign of shame on the European countries, on the US, the Western nations in general.
This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
If you ask some education experts, they'll tell you coding is as important for modern students as numeracy and literacy. One Brisbane teenager is trying to make sure it's not just city kids who learn it. Charlie McLean reports.
Understanding the language behind computer software is something of an addiction for Brisbane teenager Neth Damasiri.
It's that element that really entices me and draws me in every single time.
Coding is a key skill for anyone wanting to work in some of the fastest growing areas of the economy, like software design and cybersecurity. But getting started requires a level of access to technology not enjoyed equally around the world. A fact brought into stark relief when Neth visited rural areas of his home country, Sri Lanka, last year.
A lot of them come from farming backgrounds, so their parents are always out working. They don't have a lot of resources. Definitely don't have a lot of technology.
At the time, Neth and a school friend were already working on an ambitious coding project, a learning app called Thaddeus for beginner coders. The 17-year-olds have decided to offer the now completed app free of charge to students in developing countries.
The opportunities you get shouldn't be based on the lottery of birth, so it shouldn't be based on what country you're born into or the family you're born into.
To aid the task, they've sought help from one of Sri Lanka's most renowned philanthropists. Kashil Gunasekera's humanitarian work has earned him international recognition. He says the app's potential is exciting.
I can't adequately emphasize the need and how important it is to structure and train these kids to get to where they want to go.
Mr. Gunasekera says he can get the app into the hands of thousands of students through 22 computer labs set up by his foundation and dotted across rural Sri Lanka. And he couldn't be more impressed with the Australian teenager's generosity.
I feel that sometimes, and most times, when you help those who cannot repay the favour, it's the true hallmark of their character.
The digital divide is not just impacting the developing world.
Around about a quarter of Australia's population don't have great access to digital products.
That's University of Southern Queensland lecturer Dr. Louise Posletnik. She hopes apps like Thaddeus can help close the gap in science and tech skills between the regions and the cities.
International testing has shown that some of our regional and remote communities can be 2 years behind.
The app is expected to be in its Sri Lankan rollout later this month.
Charlie McLean with that story, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Given the string of shark attacks in New South Wales this week, should we be reconsidering our love for the ocean? Today, an expert in shark bite policy from Sydney Uni, Chris Pepin-Neff, on what led to the uptick in shark activity and what we should be doing to make swimmers and surfers safer. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.